doing well today. This is Cliff, your host, and this is a special edition of Earth Ancients podcast. Most of you know that I have a very deep focus and love for all things Mars. And that stems from my interest years ago as a conference program director and having people like Richard Hoagland on the program, who wrote the book, The Monuments of Mars. And then again, later, he and Mike Barrow wrote the book on NASA and the cover-ups and things like that. But besides those books, I've had an interesting kind of a background. I've been introduced to quite a few individuals who have worked on projects when the face on Mars was first discovered in the 70s and revealed to the general public. And since then, there's been a tremendous amount of interest in Mars. Graham Hancock wrote his book, Mysteries on Mars, where he believes there's a connection between the Earth and the ruins in the Cydonia region. And actually believes there's a pre-dynastic Egyptian connection to the ancient cultures that may have existed on the surface of the planet of Mars. Nothing has come from that since on any verification, because we just don't know. The truth is, we just don't know. JPL refuses to image the area with any significance, and luckily, the European Space Agency has re-imaged quite a few of the monuments that are there in the Cydonia region and have pretty much reinforced the evidence of artificiality in those regions and made us really, those of us who have been studying the area, it really has clarified it. But we have to think about this, because the government agencies still have not come forth. Malin and his group at JPL have still refused to acknowledge the artificiality of these structures, and we're left with evidence from a wide body of independent researchers, but no government agency acknowledging this research and saying, look, we agree, these are artificial structures, these are man-made, and we're going to point the rovers out there and we're going to go look at them. Well, I'd love for that to be the case, but I have wished for more information, for more evidence, for more research that would clarify evidence of a race of beings, of Mars being inhabitable, and I think it has finally come to light, and it actually came to light a number of months ago. In CNN, a number of major news agencies published the discoveries of my guest today, Dr. John Brandenburg. And basically what they did is they highlighted a paper that he gave at a NASA conference, where he shows scientific evidence of nuclear explosions in the Cydonia region. And we'll ask him in a little bit exactly what those papers or that paper highlights. But this is a significant bit of research. And John has written a book called Death on Mars, The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre. Now, for those of you who don't know Dr. Brandenburg, Dr. John Brandenburg is a PhD in plasma physics. He did his graduate work at Lawrence Livermore Lab in California in control plasma for fusion power, and he's worked for the Defense Energy and Space Research Organizations. Dr. Brandenburg was also part of the Clementine mission to the moon, which discovered water at the moon's pole. So that was a significant discovery. He's currently the senior propulsion scientist at Orbital Technologies Corporation in Madison, Wisconsin. John, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. Oh, I just wanted to make a correction. I've gone from Orbital Technologies, which is now a subsidiary of Sierra Nevada, to work for an organization called Morningstar. Morningstar Applied Physics. So I've made a transition to a more of a consulting mode.
Okay. And, is that still in Wisconsin, or is that somewhere
else?
Oh,
yeah. I'm still in Wisconsin. So here in Madison, Wisconsin, and which is a great place. And, you know, it's cold in the winter, but it doesn't have hurricanes. It doesn't have earthquakes, which I used to live in California and also Florida. And I lived at near the Kennedy Space Center, and we had two hurricanes hit, and that was enough.
So are you still consulting on plasma fusion and things like that?
Oh yes, definitely all the time. We filed patents on our goal is to solve the energy crisis at Morningstar with a very rational, the cleaner and safer form of nuclear power called hybrid nuclear power, where we combine fusion and fission. And we're able to burn up the nuclear waste, in fact. So it's a very exciting thing to do. And I'm one of the first books I published on Mars was called Dead Mars, Dying Earth. And it was about how Mars resembled what the Earth would look like if we didn't take better care of it. And I still believe that. I still believe that we have thrown the Earth's environment out of balance, especially by fossil fuels, and we have to get it back into balance. And I'm working all the time to try and accomplish that. So I'm not just concerned with Mars; I'm concerned with Earth. And but part of my motivation for writing the book Death on Mars was my concern for our drift into another Cold War. Kind of nuclear standoff again. This time with probably the Chinese. And but anyway, as I said in the book, and I was drawn to the problem of Mars, the discovery of the Mars face by DiPietro and Molinar and their investigation of it, because I was so concerned about the Cold War when I was working at a nuclear weapons lab in. Albuquerque, New Mexico, called Sandia Labs, and we were working on a transition from working on controlled fusion, which is, you know, to make a better, brighter future for humanity and free the country from oil. And I had to transition from that into directed energy weapons. We were trying to fire lightning bolts through the sky, basically. And have you ever seen Cliff, have you ever seen a straight lightning bolt?
No. I have not, no.
No, it turns out they like to go zigzaggy. So we were trying to aim these things, and it was impossible to aim them because they were so finicky and like to jump around so much. So that was the problem I was working on. And then the nuclear winter had happened. The nuclear winter studies had come out in around November of 1983, and also we didn't know it, but they'd had a classified, it was classified, but there had been a near nuclear war in November of 1993, triggered by a NATO war exercise called Able Archer. And the Russians were a little panic-stricken and decided that we were going to get ready to attack them. And so they put all their forces on alert, and you know, if one off course jet fighter could have triggered a nuclear war starting in Europe and then spreading around the whole world. So these were very scary times, and When I saw the when I saw the Face on Mars and the work that DePietro Molinar had done on an evening magazine, I was just stunned, and I thought, oh gosh, someone could investigate that. And I thought, my God, if that turned out to be true, that would end the Cold War.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about that. So that was your initial beginning to look at the Mars question, was DePietro and Molinar's. And what they are, just to clarify, they are imaging experts. They take images, satellite images, and they enhance and clarify them to show what's on the ground, so that government agencies can actually determine a number of different issues on the ground.
Experts at they were working for NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, and they were working on things like Landsat photos and other NASA satellites taking images.
Right.
So they were in those days. I mean, nowadays anyone with Photoshop has the same amount of computing power as they did, but in those days it was very, very high tech. We're talking big computers with big big spools of magnetic recording tape going from tape to tape, and just like in the old movies, and think $6 million man kind of things. And anyway,
so
they
the
were
face
masters
was
at that.
1974, wasn't it? Which was when their work came out, their book. Was it 74?
No, it was actually more like 79. The
79.
Viking orbiter took the picture, the original discovery picture, in 1976, while it was trying to find the Mars lander Viking 2 was supposed to land at Cydonia, but they took a picture, and they just took a bunch of pictures, decided it was too rocky, which is a very reasonable thing to say, because it is rather rocky, and they're afraid the spacecraft would hit a rock and tip over and then not be able to function when it landed. So they... no one had ever landed successfully on Mars before. They were trying to get it right. And so they were taking a whole bunch of pictures of the landing site, possible landing sites, and they discovered this picture, which they named Head. It was discovered by a young graduate student at the time. His name was Tobias Owen. And they published it. And it just created a sensation. Then they quickly said, "Oh, we took a second picture a few hours later, and the picture, the thing was gone. It was just a chance, a trick of light and shadow." And as it turns out, that wasn't true. They took the picture at about sunset, so a few hours later it was dark. They couldn't have taken another picture. And DePietro Molinar found this out and said, "Gee, why would JPL distribute erroneous information about this picture?" They went through the photo catalogs and found out that they'd waited a month, and then they came back
before
and took another picture.
They
released the picture, the original picture, very quickly, and in fact, there's even a backstory on that this was done because one fellow was annoyed that they changed the landing site without telling him. He was one of the missions. Well, these things happen on these big missions, and so he was annoyed. So he released the picture, kind of as to yank somebody's chain, because it was a very provocative picture. And then it caused a sensation because it looks archaeological. It looks like something made in old Mexico. Then they say, "Oh, well, we took another picture and it was gone," and that turned out to not be true, actually.
Right.
So this was an untrue statement by a large organization. And then they waited a month and then took a picture and never published it. And DePietro Molinar found it, and it was confirming of the. And in fact, with 5 kilometers from the face was a pyramid. Roughly five-sided pyramid, and I saw this stuff, and I was just astonished because I had thought that Mars was just dead as a doornail, and that was, believe it or not, I was trying to be very conventional in my scientific opinions at the time. I was a young graduate student, and I was a young physicist. I'd gotten my PhD, and I was establishing my career, and I was trying to be kind of conservative about everything, except and very, very focused on my job at work, which was trying to make these electron beams fly straight. So I should contact DePietro Molinari. So I did, and they sent me several pamphlets of their work. And their work was so good. The scientists and engineers at Sandia Labs just ate this stuff up.
Yeah.
They were initially skeptical, but when they saw their work and their pictures, everyone was impressed. And that these guys had done a very careful, good job, and the pamphlet explained all their image processing techniques. So it was, they really brought this whole thing to a new quantum level. And
okay,
then I found out that Dick Hoagland, in fact, Vince DiPietro informed me that Dick Hoagland was forming a independent group to basically investigate and see if they could verify everything that Greg and Vince had found. And after wrestling with the problem, I decided that I should do that because I felt that to ignore a possible discovery like this, they could end the Cold War. At the time, I just thought it would not be right because I considered the Cold War was so dangerous that we could, and I had a young daughter, and I just really wanted to try and do something to end the Cold War. So.
So when you joined Hoagland's group, that's the Independent Mars Investigation Team.
Yeah, that was what it was called.
IMIT. Yeah, IMIT. But let me ask you this: you're saying that you were worried about the Cold War. You were concerned about a nuclear detonation. Why, at that early stage of your investigation of Molinari's and DiPietro's work, would that cause you to be fearful? Did you have a suspicion that that barren area of Cydonia may have had some bomb, or what was?
Well,
that's
pretty
early on.
For someone working in defense, the whole area looks like it's been bombed. Of course, there's a lot of meteor craters, and some of them are in strings, you know. So it looks like a war zone. But, you know, you tend to put that in the back of your mind. That's something your subconscious basically says. Your conscious mind says, oh, well, this is like the moon. You know, it's got a lot of craters on it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you notice that some of the craters appear to be on some of the objects you are, you know, investigating, and you think, what are the odds of something hitting like the pyramid? And so we would discuss that in the group, the IMIT group, as we're investigating, but we never really took that idea very seriously. We were basically just trying to verify what Greg and Greg Molinar and Vince DiPietro had done. And we were able, and SRI, which was in Silicon Valley, so we were aided by a lot of Silicon Valley startups that were happening, and we were actually doing a crude form of the internet. We were doing a kind of internet conference only. We used phone modems and, you know, very old-style stuff. So it was all very exciting and enthralling. But because I was working at Sandia Labs, where they did a lot of nuclear weapons work, they were working on controlled fusion, for instance, and then they were working on directed energy weapons, and then they were doing nuclear weapons work down the street from where I worked. And so there were a lot of people who were very knowledgeable about nuclear weapons kind of walking around. One time in the library, I was Xeroxing articles from this book about the scientific results of the Viking expedition. And one of the things that had happened was that I noticed that the nuclear isotopes in the Mars atmosphere were very strange. And the scientific article had commented on how bizarre they were compared to other reference isotopic fingerprints like for Earth, or the solar wind, which is the sun's isotopes, and meteorites. Mars was much different. It had an excess of xenon-129. And I was standing in line in the library in the evening, just I was kind of hitting the library on the way home. And there was a very friendly character standing next to me who was also Xeroxing something in the library. We were waiting for the Xerox machine. And I mentioned the xenon-129 thing. He was interested in my Mars book. And when I mentioned xenon-129, he got very interested. And he says, well, I'm part of the group that measures, you know, monitors the atmosphere for, you know, if somebody sets off a nuclear test in the middle of the night in under cloud cover, and you know, we can detect it by monitoring the atmosphere. So if you know, if they were trying to halt the spread of nuclear weapons, and so they were monitoring the atmosphere to see if anyone was doing any a covert nuclear test. And he looked at the Mars, so he looked at the Mars data, and his smile vanished, and he said, "Somebody nuked them." And then he looked at me.
God.
Yeah, I mean, I got this embarrassing feeling of just piercing cold when he said this, and just because of the way he said it, and because of his very professional demeanor, he obviously knew what he was talking about. And then he looked at me, and then he just said, "Pardon me," and he put his book down, and just walked away. And what that meant at Sandia Labs, because the library was unclassified, was he had started talking about something classified in an area where it wasn't authorized. And, you know, it was just, when you work at classified programs, occasionally you start talking about stuff and you inadvertently will say something, and then you'll basically say, "Oh, pardon me, I can't talk
because
about this
anymore." Because you don't want to release data that is not classified, or it's
or
you don't
what
release
is classified data.
Data. Yeah.
Yeah. And so at the time, I didn't know why he said that. It basically took many years of, at the time, I shared this privately with some of the IMMIT members, and they were astonished and quite frightened by it. We also figured out by that time that we were under government surveillance, that they were tapping our phones. Our phones started all acting funny. And my wife, who, to her great credit, was trying to help refugees from Central America. She was part of the Central Sanctuary Movement. And she had helped sponsor some people out of detention, one of whom was actually staying at our house before he could get an apartment. And they were basically allowing them to get jobs and have an apartment and everything while waiting for their deportation hearings. And or they were trying to get asylum in Canada, basically. This fellow was from Nicaragua. Anyway, so my wife was involved in that, and some of her friends were in the Catholic Church, and they were not observing all the legal niceties of sponsoring people out of detention. They were simply hiding people who'd come across the border from the FBI and everybody. So my wife noticed that one of her friends that she would talk to, her phone would act funny whenever she would talk to her, and then her friend got arrested by the FBI for concealing illegal. And so my wife was telling me tearfully that, you know, the FBI had swept through town while I was away on a trip and had arrested a bunch of people, including her friend. And she said, "I could tell that something was going on because the phone acted funny." I said, how was it funny?" And she said, "Well, it sounded like an echo chamber sometimes.
Yeah.
It would be crackling and popping on the phone and almost a tapping noise." And then you realize, oh, I hear that all the time when I talk to my friends about Mars. And
yeah.
So we realized we were under surveillance, and some of the people at SRI kind of asked her, who have a lot of contacts with the intelligence community, kind of asked around and confirmed it. And so we realized suddenly that what we thought was a very important item, you know, the discovery of the age, the government felt it was important too. And so if anything, this made us even more resolved to finish the investigation and then report our results. So we went to the the case for Mars. It was the, I guess it was the fourth case for Mars meeting, and presented our results. And it was very well received. And one of the
things we talked
about is
the IMIT group. The IMIT group.
Yeah, the IMIT group. We all charged up to Denver, to Boulder, Colorado, and presented. Dick Hoagland was there, and I was there. Vince DiPietro, and a guy named Tom Rottenberg, and we presented, and it was well received. And curiously, one of the weird coincidences is the paper next to us was presented by Mike Malin.
Michael Malin, yes.
Michael Malin, and he was very annoyed by our paper. And it was funny, we were supposed to give like 20-minute talks, and then they would walk through people through this kind of a poster presentation. And he kept trying to talk over me, and I would talk louder, and he would keep talking louder, and I have a bigger voice. So he, anyway, I said to Vince DiPietro, I said, Vince was standing there looking amused, and I said, who is that annoying SOB? And DiPietro simply said,
Mike Malin.
Some guy named Mike Malin has got a new Mars game.
Man himself.
You know, we didn't realize at the time that we would end up just on a collision course because, as we call him in the kind of the group that I belong to now, it's called Society for Planetary SETI. We kind of call him the goalkeeper of Mars. You know, he's the hockey goalkeeper.
Yeah.
And he's.
I
want to
talk about that. Yeah. But let's go back to your work with Emmett. In the book, you use a word that I rarely read from anybody in traditional science, and that is archaeology. Can you talk a little bit about? Yeah, can you talk a little bit about? Oh well, archaeology on Mars is what I mean.
Oh yeah, archaeology on Mars. Well.
Talk a little bit about what you guys discovered, about the appearance of ruins, about the identification of the Elysian area, the pyramids of Elysia, and things like that.
What happened was one of the things that had convinced me that there was something to the DiPietro Molinari, because I had been studying the book Cosmos. Just by coincidence, I had become very interested in Mars, and I was studying the chapter on Mars in the book Cosmos by Carl Sagan. And in there, he talked, after telling us that Mars was dead as a doornail and everything, then he talked about the pyramids of Elysium and said that they were worthy of investigation. And when I first read it, I remember being slightly annoyed by, you know, why should we investigate something on a planet that looks like it's never had life on it, according to Carl? And so I examined the pictures of the Pyramids of Elysium, and they both look very interesting. And then when I saw the face on Mars in Cydonia, I realized that, you know, that if there was a face on Mars in Cydonia and pyramids in Elysium, then that suggested a planetary-wide phenomenon. So what we did in the IMIT investigation, after we verified everything that DiPietro and Molinari had done in Cydonia, we began investigating anything else that on Mars that was reported that looked like possible archaeology. We found a spectacular pyramid-shaped object in a place called Deuteranylus, to the northeast of Cydonia. And then we went around the planet. We also discovered that the northern part of the planet apparently had been an ocean. I was the person who took the lead in discovering that. And so we were basically going around the shoreline of the ocean looking for new archaeological sites and finding them. And there was a place, finally I had looked at Cydonia and said, I was studying some archaeological books on archaeology, and they talked about an archaeological site model, and basically ancient cities used to be found near rivers, normally near something, some kind of prominent high ground so they could use it as defense, and also near the ocean. so I found another spot on Mars that was on the shore of the ocean, sort of high, near high ground, and I had a river near it, and ordered pictures of it sight unseen. It was an area of Mars called Utopia, and near the edge of what's called the plane of Utopia. And I got the pictures, and I could see suddenly ruins. Basically, there were mesas, and then everything was really smooth, very smooth landscape. And there would be mesas, and then suddenly the mesas would have ruins on top of them, or what looked like rubble. And finally, what looked like a rubble of a city, and beside it, two faces, one of which looked very similar to the face on Mars. It's Cydonia. So,
okay, talk about these two faces. I want to hear your description, because you have one face that, and I've seen this in your book, your one face actually has a figure with a helmet on.
Yes, and, just like the one in Cydonia.
Yeah, and you actually refer to the Olmec
yes.
sculptures as a similar kind of a helmet
structure. We've got to send Mexicans to Mars, because they will understand this stuff. I tell my friends who are, you know, a Mexican ancestry, you know, you guys got to go to Mars, because you'll understand this stuff better than us Northern Europeans. And so it's all it is. There's definitely a tie-in somehow to the same style of sculpture as was found in old Mexico, peculiarly enough. And so, yeah, and what was fascinating was also when we publicized the fact that we'd found this other site with these two faces, I showed pictures to some Mars scientists, and they were just really stunned, especially because I showed the similarities between that and the face in Cydonia. And Carl Sagan heard about it. And so I ended up talking to Carl Sagan, and he said, could you maybe send me some pictures of this new thing you found? Mm-hmm. And so I had a bunch of pictures, and I stuffed them in an envelope, wrote on it, Carl Sagan, you know, Cornell University, Space Sciences Building, you know, all the zip code and everything, and put it in the mailbox immediately and watched the mail truck leave with it, because I got there just before the mail truck. Mm-hmm. Then I ended up leaving Sandia Labs. It was my first job out of school, and what happened was I managed to solve the problem of the electron beams not flying straight, but I contradicted a senior person doing this.
Oh, his theory.
He had said that they asked me what to do, and I said, we should spin the beams so they'll be like rifled bullets and fly straight, and he had said that, oh, no, that'll never work, and then I was proved right. I told a friend, I said, if I'd been proved wrong, I could have been forgiven, but instead I was proved right, and this guy took it very personally. So I just thought, okay, life is too short to horse around like this, and so I left, and I took a job in Washington. Well, I spent 2 weeks on Maui, with my wife and daughter, and then I went to Washington D.C. to start working on the Reagan Star Wars defense thing, which was space. You know, I love space, and so anyway, when I got to Washington D.C., I called Carl Sagan's office just to see what he thought of the pictures, and he wasn't in. We didn't have cell phones in those days, so everybody was playing telephone. We called it telephone tag, and he would call back. I would be out of the office on some sales expedition to one of the many government agencies around there, because I was part of a marketing campaign for our scientific work. And so I'd come back to the office, and the office manager, who was this really nice lady, she was really cute, and she'd say, Carl Sagan called for you, John. And you were not here, and so he wants you to call him back. So I'd call him back, and of course he wouldn't be in his office. This went on for 2 weeks. And the office manager kept reporting, well, Carl Sagan called again today, and he was rather snippy with me. So finally, I was having a conference with my boss on some sales thing about some Star Wars thing we were going to do, and the office manager walks in and says, Carl Sagan is on the phone, and my boss, his eyes get as big as saucers. She says, he wants to talk to John. So I excused myself and went to the office and started talking to, got connected with Carl. And so I said, well, Carl, what did you think of the new pictures? And he says, I never got them. And we both, there was just this long 2 minutes of silence. And then I said, okay, I'm going to give you the frame numbers and where it is on Mars, and you can see for yourself, you know, from your own data. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, I'm going to fax you a picture of the, a fax of the image. In those days, we just had faxes, you know, with the two objects circled. And so, it was as if somebody had apparently intercepted the pictures, and they wanted us to know that we were under surveillance. It was fairly obvious at that point. And they may have been putting a lot more pressure on Carl Sagan than on me, actually, because I've heard that, he was pressured by the government, for one thing, not to get interested in UFOs and just keep talking about the planet Jupiter, Carl.
Right.
And all of us will get along really well.
So he got the photographs of those two heads, right?
Yes. And it's funny, they renamed the area Galaxus Chaos, gave it this amazingly poetic name. We just called it Utopia, or, you know, edge of Utopia Planum,
right?
The plane of Utopia. And no, they gave it its own name, Galaxius Chaos, which means milky cliff area. But actually, it was obvious to me that somebody's galaxy had been thrown into chaos by this. So deep within the planetary community, they knew that we were looking at strong evidence for a planetary-wide dead civilization on Mars. In fact, Galaxus Chaos is just north of where the pyramids of Elysium are. By the way, we did get more pictures. We found a second picture of the pyramids of Elysium, which showed us that the government, even though it kept saying, oh, this is nothing, would go back and investigate itself. But what's interesting is, Cliff, what is really fascinating, the U.S. government has gone out and procured all this data for our investigation and keeps procuring it. I mean, they took all these new pictures of the face on its Cydonia and put it in the public record. If there was a real cover-up by the government, none of that would have happened. In fact, we wouldn't even be investigating. So instead, the government has basically put us on a collision course with this. You must also remember, the U.S. government is the one that publicized the fact that they'd found microfossils in that meteorite ALH-8401. Mm-hmm. It was Johnson Space Flight Center.
Okay.
Who wants to do a manned mission to Mars. Now, the people who have resisted all of this is Jet Propulsion Lab and its contractors. And they're just doing a robotic investigations of Mars. And we found from, when I worked on the Clementine mission, one of our mission consultants was a scientist who'd worked at JPL. And he told me over coffee, he said, because I mentioned the face on Mars to him, and he said, well, John, you got to understand, at JPL, they don't want to find anything really exciting on Mars. Because if they do, they know there'll be pressure for a human mission to Mars, and as one manager had told him, the astronauts will come with their big rockets and take Mars away from us.
Yeah, I read that in your book, which I thought was interesting. But I have to ask you.
So
this is
what you call big institutional science. Is in fact, the U.S. government, on the other hand, has actually gotten all this data and publicized it, and we think basically that they want it to come out at this point.
But you make some interesting points in your book. You and the IM. Emmett, a group, concluded that Mars had an Earth-like period.
Yes.
And I quote you, it had been successful. What does that mean? What is a Earth-like
Mars period became mean? Mars became a thriving place just like Earth. It needed a greenhouse like Venus. I mean, temperatures at the surface of Venus are roughly double what they are on the planet Mercury, even though Mercury is twice as close to the sun, because of this very dense layer of carbon dioxide and water on the surface and water vapor, you know, in the Venetian atmosphere. So Venus has a very dense atmosphere of carbon dioxide, traps a lot of heat, and so therefore the surface temperatures on Venus are higher than they are on Mercury. So Mars, and by the way, that has been in place apparently as long as the planet Venus has existed, 4.5 billion years. So on Mars, you had a similar persistent greenhouse, a very heavy carbon dioxide atmosphere. And what happens then is that you got a Earth-like climate system on Mars, even though it was farther from the sun. And this, you have what is called a planetary Gaia, where the Earth life begins to thrive on the planet. For one thing, it creates an ozone layer. This protects the life on the planet Mars, allows life to thrive even more. And so basically you have a self-stabilized, thriving environment, just like Earth. And then something happened, and apparently this persisted on Mars for most of Mars history. One thing you must understand about the Mars ocean, and I actually was the first person to propose it. You can check on Wikipedia. I'm reference number one, and because one of the Mars scientists said, "Well, we really liked your Mars presentation, especially your ocean. We don't know about the face, but if you don't talk about the face, why don't you just talk about the ocean by itself?" And so I did that. I followed his advice, and I got up in front of an audience of about 1,000 Mars scientists, presented this whole ocean filling the northern plains of Mars, and they loved it. Now, because of my Cydonia Association, I am considered the person, he who must not be cited on Mars.
Oh,
my name must not be spoken. So Wikipedia finally rectified this. They give me credit for being the first person to propose it. And I'm, you know, reference number one in their list of references. And so so the Mars ocean became an accepted part of Mars. It's now been verified that there was an ocean. That ocean lasted most of Mars' geologic history. We know that because it's on the youngest part of Mars.
Right. So during the Gaia phase, which is green, lush, it has an atmosphere, how long ago was this thriving community during the period that these massive, massive structures were built?
The structures apparently were not built brick by brick. They were basically, they took existing landforms and shaped them. Like if they had a hill that looked maybe like a face, they removed thousands of tons of rock and soil and probably covered it also with brick facing to so it wouldn't erode and turned it into a face staring up at space. And the same with the pyramid. So we don't think they actually built these things brick by brick. So it took about as much work as it did to construct the pyramids on, remember, also Mars has a lower gravity. So it takes like about 20,000 men working for, or human equivalents working for 20 years to build these things. And they probably were built over several thousand years.
And these two faces that you discovered in the Elysium area, what is the approximate dimensions of them?
Oh, well, the faces in Galaxis Chaos, which is near Elysium, are about a mile from top of the helmet to the chin, and they're about 3/4 of a mile across. The face at Cydonia is even larger. It's about a mile and a half long. and about a mile wide.
Wow.
So the ones at Galaxis Chaos are roughly two-thirds the size of the one at Cydonia. But
they're
you can
smaller.
See the same, yeah, as I show in the book. And by the way, I give all the frame numbers so anyone can verify these pictures by
okay.
going to the data service and calling up the frame numbers. So
okay.
this is, and some of the pictures are so such high resolution, we can see brickwork around the nose on the Galaxis Chaos face, the upper face, which is the one that looks like Cydonia. It's got brickwork around the nose.
Mm-hmm.
And so this thing is sort of obvious now that it was a
okay.
dead. There's a dead. It's fairly, as I say to audiences, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what this means.
So
Mars
you're
like Earth.
Totally convinced. Yeah, you're totally convinced
yeah.
that this is artificiality. These are man-made or being-made. So let's go back to the initial question. What was the Gaia period? How long ago? What's
the Gaia
the
period?
Age?
Oh, that lasted
yeah.
until probably about half a billion years ago, roughly about the time of the Earth's Precambrian period, which is coincidentally. Earth had life on it from its very earliest. Apparently, they find bacterial fossils in Earth rocks roughly beginning at the time when we had a liquid ocean. So
mm-hmm.
as soon as there was liquid water on Earth, apparently there was life. And
okay.
so at Mars, apparently, the life started even quicker because Mars cooled off quicker. It's a smaller planet, so it had less latent heat when it formed. So the Mars meteorite is 4.5 billion years old. It's got signs of life in it that are roughly 4 billion years old. So Mars had life on it like Earth. And then like Earth, they basically Earth and Mars followed a parallel course. The life got dug in, started making oxygen in the atmosphere. And then mm-hmm. At Earth... about 4.5 billion years ago, we had what's called the Precambrian explosion, where there was suddenly an enormous diversification of life from being just single-cell bacteria to multicellular creatures, trilobites, and the oxygen
mm-hmm.
atmosphere became, the oxygen became a very important component of the Earth atmosphere around the Precambrian. On Mars, apparently Mars is red, and it's red for the same reason. If you look at pictures of Earth from space, the deserts are bright red because the surface was highly oxidized. They had a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere early on. And so Mars was a thriving place, oxygen atmosphere, greenhouse effect, and then something happened to it about half a billion years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We initially thought it was an asteroid impact. There is evidence for a large asteroid impact. And then sometime after the asteroid impact, which was near Cydonia, two enormous nuclear explosions, one near Cydonia, one near Galaxis Chaos.
Okay, let me stop you right there. Let me stop you right
yes.
there. So in the book, you actually outline this this asteroid hit, and then
yes.
you actually calculated that a million years later, there was a nuclear destruction around the Cydonia
right.
region. So,
and it
so
looks
that would
as
be about
Mars,
what time?
About half, roughly, we're talking approximately about a quarter of a billion years ago. It looks as though Mars may have recovered. The crater is as big as Chicxulub, the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. So it looks
oh, okay.
as though Mars may have recovered from the asteroid impact and started thriving again. And at this point, the life was not only just life, but intelligent life was there and built these big monuments. And
okay.
then a nuclear catastrophe occurred, or a nuclear attack. And we've now found evidence from satellite pictures. They found what looks like melt glass. Thousands of square miles of Mars surface were turned to glass, just like in nuclear tests on Earth. And these were airbursts. These were not there's nothing natural about them. That something nuclear exploded in midair, it showered the surface with neutrons. We have that evidence from the Mars meteorite. Some of them are heavily irradiated with neutrons. It turned thousands of square miles of Mars surface to glass, glass called trinitite, formed by nuclear explosions. And it filled the atmosphere with radioactive, with isotopes that are seen after nuclear explosions on Earth, the xenon-129.
Okay, let me stop you right there. This is the most important part of your analysis, of your training, is that you actually have measured the isotope radius on Mars and have determined, not randomly, but through science, that these isotopes are the result of a nuclear explosion. Now, I want you to tell our audience how you come to that conclusion and what the actual evidence is for these nuclear explosions.
For one thing, anyone can go on the web and call up maps of Mars potassium and maps of Mars thorium, and you'll discover there's a big hotspot of radioactivity in what's called Mare Acidalium, which is right next to where Cydonia is. And it's in potassium. The potassium is more radioactive than normal there, and so is the thorium, both of which are radioactive for a long time. Now, so you can see that on the maps. And the debris pattern from those places stretches all the way around the planet and collides. Apparently, a shockwave started in Mare Acidalium, went all the way around the planet and collided with itself on the far side at a place called an antipode. In other words, the exact opposite spot on the globe from where the explosion occurred. So there's that evidence. The Mars surface is covered with a thin layer of radioactive stuff. They've confirmed that because the Mars meteorites we get have much less potassium, uranium, and thorium in them than what's evident on the surface. And the Mars rocks, the meteorites are believed to be basement rocks from about 10 feet down that are thrown into space by an explosion. Whereas the surface, it can be measured from orbiting spacecraft. The Mars atmosphere is so thin, you can measure radiation right through the atmosphere. So the top surface of Mars is, and this is all in the book, by the way, in color plates, so you can see it very graphically. Then the xenon-129 spike, overabundance in the Mars atmosphere, there is only one planetary atmosphere where that feature is seen, and that is Earth. There's a component of the Earth's atmosphere that has changed since 1945, and it's due to nuclear explosions and also plutonium production, both of which require fast neutrons. Normally, when you run a nuclear reactor, you run slow neutrons because this the neutrons can split atoms far more effectively if they move slowly. But to make plutonium, you want a fast neutron reactor. It uses graphite moderator, which doesn't slow down the neutrons like water does. And that's, in fact, what Chernobyl was. It was actually making plutonium as well as power. That's why it blew up and had that terrible graphite fire. But on the United States, the Soviet Union, China, everybody make plutonium using these fast neutron reactors. And it makes a lot of xenon-129 because when the xenon-129 is a symptom of fast neutron fission, just like in a bomb. In a bomb, of course, there's no moderator. You get a bunch of plutonium or a bunch of uranium. It starts splitting in a chain reaction, and neutrons travel very fast. And so they use weapons grade, 100% uranium 235 or plutonium for that. So, but if you've been monitoring the Earth's atmosphere, there's about five stable xenon isotopes. And one of them is xenon-129, and that, as I show in the book, has increased like 10% since 1945. The other xenon isotopes have hardly increased at all. So it is a symptom, it is a weapon signature. So okay. What we have found on Mars is weapon signature in association with these big explosions. By the way, my first hypothesis that I published was that it was a natural nuclear reactor that went unstable and blew up. Everyone liked that because on Earth, in Africa, they had natural nuclear reactors. But on Mars, this would have been an enormous, unstable one that it blew up. However, there's no crater. That means it can't have been a nuclear reactor, natural nuclear reactor. That would have had to have been in the ground. It would have blown up and made an enormous crater. Also, a natural nuclear reactor, like any natural reactor, runs on slow neutrons. Mm-hmm. And because it uses water as a moderator, this is a fast neutron reaction. This is a weapons. There's weapon signature in the Mars atmosphere.
Okay.
And from enormous nuclear weapons, not just small ones like we make. These ones were as big as the Empire State Building, and apparently went off at two places, one near Cydonia, one near Galaxis.
Now, do we know? Based on your analysis, at what level were they dropped out of the atmosphere? Were they exploded on the ground?
No, they were exploded in midair. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the atomic bombs were exploded in midair because that creates more shock damage.
Okay.
That was not done for humanitarian reasons. It doesn't create a crater. And instead of the shock waves being expended, making a big crater, the shock waves go and destroy all the buildings over a wide area.
Okay.
So that is what the weapons experts use to destroy cities, is air what are called air bursts.
Okay. And so do we know based? Go ahead and finish.
Also the explosions were so enormous. If they'd been on the ground, they would have made enormous craters on Mars. But if you look in the center of these hot spots for radioactivity, or where the trinitite glass is, which is, by the way, in the same spot as the radioactivity is, there's no crater. It's a smooth, very smooth, small, you know, there's a few little tiny craters, but there's no big crater. There's nothing to suggest this thing went off near the ground. That means they had to have basically been dropped from outer space. On Mars to blow them, even if they wanted to blow themselves up in suicidal rage, they would have blown it off on the ground and made big craters. Instead, somebody has to have dropped these things from outer space. So this suggests a much more advanced culture. The Cydonia culture looks rather primitive, by the way. It looks like Bronze Age, Mayan, or Egyptian, early Egyptian. It does not look like an advanced culture. So the disparity in technology between whoever killed them and the culture on Mars looks just pathetic.
So tell me what you, as a weapons expert, feel, because I've read numerous articles that speculate, and I don't know if they're quoting you or not, but they speculate, or they actually describe that somebody intentionally bombed Mars in the Cydonia region with the intent of genocide, basically wiping these people off the face of the earth. Is that what you think it is?
That's what it looks like.
Okay.
Somebody dropped two enormous hydrogen bombs, apparently from outer space. The bombs were as big as the Empire State Building each. They were hydrogen bombs wrapped in thorium and uranium to create more fallout. And when you wrap a hydrogen bomb in uranium or thorium, this used to be classified, it's no longer classified, it doubles the yield because the neutrons from the high energy neutrons from the fusion split the uranium atoms, and even if they're not U-235, it's the regular uranium ore, 238, and thorium also splits. And so it looks as though they were committing genocide on Mars. Someone.
Okay. This is
so
amazing.
Someone, a primitive species, we had a what looked like a primitive species on Mars, constructing mm-hmm. things that look like old Mexico or the Mayans or Egypt, ancient mm-hmm. Egypt. And then somebody came along and dropped two enormous hydrogen bombs on them that went off in midair to create, they did it just upwind of Cydonia and Galaxis. People ask me, mm-hmm. why do you connect the hydrogen bomb explosion evidence with Cydonia and Galaxis? And I tell them, because I can read a map. The prevailing mm-hmm. winds on Mars blow to the southeast and the north, just like they do on Earth. It's it's Coriolis winds. And the fallout and the worst shock waves would have gone downwind and hit Cydonia Mensa and Galaxis Chaos from these two explosions.
Okay. It blows my mind to hear what you're saying, because gone through your book and I'm still stunned at it. And I want you to talk a little bit about what the Brooks Institute found and what their reaction is to discoveries of alien artifacts, because this is an important fact, and I believe it's one of the reasons why the government is only releasing bits and pieces of evidence of your work and possibly other evidence from other scientific community or individuals on alien artifacts, on alien civilizations. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Brookings Institute study? We've heard it from Mike Barra, but basically it describes an emotional and conscious reaction to alien discoveries. But go ahead, and why don't you tell us what you...
The Brookings report was done... done in conjunction with, like, I guess, the RAND Corporation. When they were founding mm-hmm. NASA, they asked the Brookings Institution to do a study with its smartest people. You know, what is NASA going to do? What should we expect to be its societal impact? You know, would it be positive, mm-hmm. negative? And of course, space is there's nothing that gets students of science and math interested in science and math more than space. I can tell you as a college instructor.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was they did this study and they said, oh, you're probably going to find remains of dead civilizations on planets around the solar system, or signs of extraterrestrial past visitation. They put mm-hmm. that in the report. So it's part of the DNA, founding DNA of NASA, that they would find signs of, like we're finding on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were already kind of primed for that. Also, you must understand the government is much more skeptical about scientific opinions of scientists than the public, because they deal with them all the time. Mm-hmm. They basically believed the work of Lowell, which said that Mars may have had an Earth-like past. So they were basically prepared to find a dead civilization on Mars.
And oh, interesting.
So they were primed for that. And so when they found one, they basically decided to let the data come out and for a scientific debate to occur. They didn't cover it up. And so what has happened now is that they've gathered more data. The government has. It's released it. They may have suppressed some evidence, but we don't, they've released so much that the case can be made just on the base of the evidence we found. So they expected this from the very beginning at NASA. And mm-hmm. now we have found it. And interestingly enough, the U.S. government, I regard as one of the heroes in this, because they expected to find this and they charged on ahead and found more evidence. And public, the data is all there, as I show in the book. I have all the frame numbers, so anyone can look up these frame numbers.
Okay.
The original data.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Am I answering your question, Cliff?
No. The point I wanted to make was the Brookings Institute said that there
would
be a public reaction to the discovery of alien artifacts, and that they would be very uncomfortable. And in many cases, it would disrupt
societal norms.
And we understand that. Collision of primitive cultures on Earth with more advanced cultures, even if the advanced cultures didn't come in and conquer them, the primitive cultures kind of go into psychological shock.
Right.
They thought they were the center of the universe. They find out they're not.
Right. Right. So the basis of the point I'm trying to make, John, is that because of this Brookings Institute report, maybe our government is trying to be open about it, but organizations like JPL and other private contracted organizations are not releasing the data that they are capturing.
As I point out in the book and give a reference, Mike Malin faced a revolt from Mars scientists because he became he wanted to apparently look at every new picture from Mars with his new camera, and he basically had a data embargo. And a bunch of scientists got together and said, "Look, he's keeping all of this Mars data bottled up and won't let us work with it. How can we do our jobs if they're, we're sent a probe to Mars and we're supposed to get new data and he's not giving us the data?" So they staged a big protest and got him in a lot of trouble. And this was back in about 1998. And he's already been in trouble once with the Mars community for embargoing data. But it seems to me, they've released so much data now, it's fairly obvious from the data they released that there's a dead civilization there. And the other data that's released by the nuclear people makes it obvious that there was giant nuclear explosions. So if there may be a few details they're withholding, I don't know why at this point. But at the same time, if you're in the government, you're worried about public morale constantly. Remember, we were in the Cold War then.
Yeah.
They didn't want one of the things they did when the Cold War started is they put "In God We Trust" on the coins. And this is a very religious country, and a lot of people who are religious are not really comfortable with the idea of extraterrestrial life. So they were constantly worried about that. But people are much more mature now. I think people are ready. They're ready to find this.
Mm-hmm.
We're ready. We're completely acclimated now to the idea that we are not alone in the universe. We're ready. So now the next steps. I wanted to mention that Don Ecker, he was then working for UFO Magazine. He was the guy who unearthed the Brookings Report, finding out that the U.S. government expected to find this, and also that if they did find it, they thought they should suppress it to prevent societal damage. By the way, there's an example of a society that encountered Western technology. It was quite primitive, but it encountered Western nations and their technology and adapted marvelously to that, and that's Japan. Japan was was the feudal, semi-isolated kingdom, a hermit kingdom. And then in the 1800s, from about 1850 up to 1900, they completely reorganized their society. They adopted all the Western technology. They preserved their own culture. And they became a thoroughly modern nation in about 50 years. And so that shows what the human race can do if it reacts positively to encountering a new world that they used to think they were they were God's only and most beloved child, and then they found out they weren't. But they reacted positively to that, and so I think that.
Right.
This gives us an example of a society that reacted very positively to this, and that's my model for how the human race should be.
Okay, so we have about 5 minutes left. I have two questions to ask you.
One is a forecast, but the first one, I want you to talk a little bit about Malin's use of his JPL equipment. And as an example, he re-imaged the face after tremendous pressure. He re-imaged the face, and
yes.
What he did is shot it in such a way that it looks like they call it the cat box. But
oh, yeah, it looks, yes.
Before I finish, a few years later, ESA, European Space Agency, and their satellite re-imaged the face beautifully, dead straight
yep.
on, in perfect light, and shows how beautiful it actually is. Why would Malin spend, I don't know, millions of dollars to shoot an angle to make this monument look like it's a mess?
I know.
At our expense.
Well, I think when the truth has finally come out about Mike Malin, he'll probably just say, hey, I was just following orders. Mike Malin is a superb scientist, and I've met him several times. He's, he's a very dedicated, very superb scientist for making these cameras and everything, doing all his data management.
Okay.
But he'll probably just say, I was just following orders. Guys, I was just following orders. So what he did was when they wanted, he was under pressure to take a picture of the face. And like a lot of people who are really passionate about his work, he talks a lot. And so he was talking about, he was going to image the little Sojourner Mars rover on Mars, the Pathfinder rover, which is only as big as my kitchen table. And so he was saying, but then they'd ask him to image the face on Mars. He'd say, oh, it's too small. I probably won't be able to get it with my camera. So he was making all these ridiculous statements. He was engaging in a furious battle with Dick Hoagland, between their two websites. And so then he was pressured to take a picture. So what he did is, and it looks like a classic PSYOPs, you know, where they had real psychological experts. They took a picture from the side, so it was almost a profile. And they also deliberately didn't enhance it.
Right.
So it looked like an object in a cat litter box or a, you know,
right.
So that's what we called it. And so what Mark Carlotto, who had enjoyed the investigation, is just a genius at image processing. He took it and enhanced it and showed, gosh, it's got nostrils in the nose.
Yeah.
It's got, it's got ornaments on the helmet, like the Olmec heads. Mm-hmm. And we made those pictures available to Dan Golden. We
right.
dropped all the new pictures off to Dan Golden at NASA headquarters to his personal assistant. So Dan Golden saw them all. And you know what Dan Golden said? He says, oh, one picture isn't enough. We're going to have to take more pictures. So he ordered them to take repeated pictures until the matter was settled. And, of course, that doomed them because they couldn't cover up multiple pictures, which clearly showed, once we found out that it showed the elm nostrils in the nose, which was not available from the Viking. You couldn't see the nostrils from the Viking pictures. And the ornaments on the helmet, there was only, Mark Carlotto had found what looked like ornaments on the helmet, very indistinct, and then they were confirmed by the new pictures. And it was all there. So the cover-up basically ended there, and we went to a scientific meeting and posted all these pictures. And one of these guys from JPL showed up who worked with Mike Malin and just about went catatonic. In fact, he threatened he was going to punch DiPietro. Here's this skinny little professor raging at DiPietro And DiPietro started asking him technical questions like, oh, why is the grayscale so narrow, et cetera. And this guy starts screaming at him, you don't know what you're talking about. Are you calling me a liar? I'll deck you, by God. I mean, everyone is. He made an enormous scene at this scientific convention. And so DiPietro just stood his ground, and I got in between them and, you know, told the guy to calm down and let him away. Vince said, John, you should have let him hit me. Then I could have sued him. but I think this is best. And so we ended the cover up right there in front of a scientific meeting. And so everybody knows. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows this now.
Okay.
And so they, by the way, Mike Malin and his crew deliberately misled the public. And people say,
what I believe. Yeah.
The deliberate misrepresentation of scientific results in the public. And I think there should be an inquiry. But he will probably just say, well, the people who paid me told me to do it.
Exactly.
And the people who paid him have all retired.
Right.
And so, so anyway, I think the cover-up's over. The cat is now out of the bag. The magic beans are spilled. So
it's fantastic. Dr. John Brandenburg's been my guest. The book is called Death on Mars, The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre.
Amazon.com.
You can get it at Amazon.com. It's out right now. I am going to be publishing a few photographs from the book, just a few, on my Facebook page with a link to the Amazon photo. Yeah, and also we're going to have you back on the program, John.
Oh, great, Cliff. I really enjoy that.
Yeah.
We can talk about, by the way, we can talk about the larger implications. This in the context of what's called Fermi's paradox, but we'll take that up at another time.
Okay, I'll look forward to it. Just fantastic. Thank you for joining us. So that's the program today, and I want to make sure that everyone does go to the Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook, and take a look at all these photographs that are published in Dr. John Brandenburg's book, Death on Mars, The Discovery of Planetary Nuclear Massacre. Until I speak with you again, I hope you have a great day. Thank you.